Exodus 5:21 through 6:9, and Israel as a Nation to Date. The eighth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on May 19, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
This week I digressed. I spent the time talking about the applicability of these narratives to our lives. So let me remind you where we left off in the narratives. Moses had returned to Egypt, and as God had told him to do, he showed the signs to the Israelites, and the Israelites believed that he was indeed sent by God. Then he went to the Pharaoh and asked the Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. And the Pharaoh said, I'd rather not. And in fact, he made life more difficult for the Israelites. He decided that the problem was they were lazy. So he required that they make the same number of bricks, maintain their daily quotas, but this time without being supplied the straw necessary to make the bricks. So, since the Israelites had difficulty making those new, that quotas with that new element added, the foremen, the Israelite foremen who were overseeing the workmen, the slaves, were beaten every time they failed to meet the quotas. And so these foremen went and addressed Pharaoh and explained to him, it just can't be done. We were doing just fine before, thank you, but we can't make it now. We can't make our quotas. And in hopes that Pharaoh would relent and change his requirements. But Pharaoh did not do so. Pharaoh refused to change the quotas. So the foreman left their session with the Pharaoh and walked out. And Moses and Aaron had been standing there, apparently waiting to see how this would turn out. And the foreman denounced Moses. In verse 21 of chapter 5, and they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." So earlier, the Israelites had been convinced that he was indeed sent by God. But now, with this new turn of events, now they're saying, "May God judge you." Just something to point out here. They don't condemn God in this situation. Rather, they condemn Moses. They're seeing him as one who has falsely represented God. But consistently in Exodus, God refuses to make a distinction between the two. They complain about Moses, but God says it's rebellion against me that's actually happening. It doesn't mention that here, but we'll see that later on. Moses' response, though, to this is to plead for mercy for his people. In verse 22, "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why hast thou brought harm to this people? Why didst thou ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he has done harm to this people, and thou hast not delivered thy people at all." So Moses is moved by this and asks for mercy. Mercy on his people. That now that God would actually move and take positive action to bring about change and relieve them of their misery. In the first part of chapter 6, then, we see what God's response was to Moses' plea. Let me read the first 9 verses. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For under compulsion he shall let them go, and under compulsion he shall drive them out of his land." God spoke further to Moses, and he said to him, "I am the Lord. And I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, Lord, I did not make myself known to them. And I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they sojourned. And furthermore, I have heard the groanings of the sons of Israel because the Egyptians are holding them in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the sons of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage. I will also redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. Then I will take you from my people, and I will be your God, and ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord." So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. God indicates here that he is going to have mercy. He is going to act upon Moses' plea. Now he is going to take active, positive measures to bring about the release of the Israelites. And he indicates that he is going to, this arrogant and powerful Pharaoh is going to end up under duress, by compulsion, not only letting the people go, but God is going to bring about the situation in such a way that he will actually force them to leave. He'll be pushing them out, indicating quite a change in the situation. Now, God goes on to say, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty," or El Shaddai, "but by my name, Lord, I did not make myself known to them." Now, it could be that what he's saying is, they didn't know that name. That's a new name I've come up with and I'm fond of now, and I've changed it. It could be that he's saying, I have a whole new name, and I did not reveal to them my old name. That would be a little strange in that Yahweh shows up throughout Genesis. So if that is the case, then whoever wrote Genesis then went back and wrote in God's new name. I think it more likely that what he's saying is, there is going to be a new manifestation of me. They knew me in a certain way. They knew me categorized as El Shaddai. But now they're going to see a new face of me. See a new aspect of my character, of my being. Long ago, people noticed that there is a pattern in the use of two words that refer to God. One is Yahweh and the other is Elohim. Yahweh is generally translated Lord. So when you see Lord, at least in my Bible, it's in small capital letters. That's the way they've decided to translate Yahweh. And Elohim is usually translated God. So sometimes you'll see God said this and that and the other thing. Sometimes you'll say the Lord. You'll see the Lord said such and such. And sometimes you'll see the Lord God. Well, they've just taken those terms and translated them into those English words. And it was noticed by Bible scholars in the 19th century that there is this pattern that sometimes God is referred to one way and sometimes the other way and sometimes both ways. And it was based on that observation that a theory was derived, that claims that the Bible is the Old Testament is the result of different oral traditions. That there's an oral tradition about this God called Yahweh, and there's this oral tradition about this God called Elohim, and that at some point in time, those stories were just clumsily put together. And wherever the stories had elements, the two different traditions contained similar stories or the same stories, then they referred to the God in those cases as Yahweh Elohim, or the Lord God. And that theory, that I'm in very rough terms, that's the theory. Then generally there are two more editors that come along. One who wanted to weave the Old Testament law into that historical narrative. And then another editor who wanted to justify the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, and wrote in justifications for the priesthood throughout those that story. So in very crude terms, that's the documentary hypothesis that was advanced most notably by Wellhausen in the 19th century. But there was a pastor by the name of Wilhelm Moeller who wrote a book in 1912 who noticed, who drew a different conclusion from that pattern of names, Yahweh and Elohim. And when he looked at it, what he noticed is that Elohim is used in certain kinds of circumstances when God is functioning in a certain way, and Yahweh is used when God is functioning in another way. And the way he saw it, Elohim is used when we see God acting in nature, doing marvelous works in nature. And Yahweh is used when it refers to God in his capacity as revealing himself, or revealing his will, or his law. And Yahweh Elohim then is used when both functions of God are happening at the same time. Now, I don't know, I haven't read his book, I don't know whether I find that reasoning compelling or not, whether those are two indeed functions of God that are designated by those different names. But I am attracted to that kind of solution, and I suspect that that kind of solution is probably right, that the two names are indicating two different functions of God rather than indicating two different oral traditions that were woven together. If that's the case, I suspect we have the same thing happening here. That what God is saying is, the patriarchs knew me in one kind of function. They saw one side of me. But now, you're going to see a different side of me, one that has not been seen by the patriarchs. I'm going to function differently here. Now, are there any clues from the text as to what those two different functions might be? I think there are. He says, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord, I did not make myself known to them. He says, and I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan. So as El Shaddai, he promised them, he made a covenant, he promised them, he made a promise to them to give them the land of Canaan. And then it goes on to say, the land in which they sojourned. Later on it says, in verse 8, I will give it to you for a possession. So the patriarchs made promises to them, grand promises. But he didn't take steps to fulfill those promises. He gave them the land of Canaan. He said, I will give you this land forever. But what in fact happened? He took them there, he showed them the land, and then he had them move on to Egypt. They did not take it as a possession. this is not mentioned in the text, but you can think of other examples. For instance, God told Abraham that his descendants would be as the sand. He had one. So it's hard, it's a step in the direction, but it's hardly a very promising beginning. It doesn't look like, for sure, that God is going to come through with his promises. So it appears to me that the two functions that are being pointed out here is, one is El Shaddai. He came to the patriarchs and he made great promises. But now he is going to appear as Yahweh to the people of Israel, as one who acts in history to fulfill those great promises. And that's something new. That's something they have not seen. And the story of Exodus then is an account of God doing that, of God being the kind of God that works mightily in human history to fulfill the promises that he made 400 years earlier. So he's the one who delivers on his promises. And he does it in a manner that it's obvious to all. It's obvious to the Israelites. He makes it obvious to the Egyptians. And as we see in Deuteronomy, he makes it obvious even to the surrounding peoples who have nothing to do with it. What is God going to achieve? What promise? What does he say that he will achieve through his mighty works? He has quite a list of things. I will bring you out from under your burdens. I will deliver you from bondage. Redeem you with a show of power and judgment. He doesn't mention it, but quite notably, Pharaoh dies in a few chapters. I will make you my people. I will be your God. You will know that I did this. I will bring you to the promised land, and I will give it to you to possess. It will be a possession to you. So in essence, he has outlined all of his goals, all of the things that he is about to accomplish in the rest of the book of Exodus. And he's going to do it in very dramatic fashion. There will be no question to any observer that in fact God had acted mightily to bring these things about. So Moses goes back to the people of Israel and relays this to them. But they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and their cruel bondage. I've mentioned this before, but it is striking. The Israelites, just like us, are focused on the moment. We can't see very far back with clarity, and we can't see into the future with clarity. We are very much oriented on the present. If things are going badly at the present, then it's as if things were always bad. And it's hard for us to think otherwise. It's hard for us to keep in vivid memory what God has done. And yet God is going to do a number of things in Exodus. Very dramatic events. Clear signs of God's power and his love and compassion for his people. And yet the pattern is, soon after that, they forget. Because things get miserable. They become despondent as a result of their current situation and just can't remember the past. I had forgotten about this passage and I found it rather intriguing. An implication of this is that God has different faces. God's doing different things at different times. There are very few times in history like the Exodus. That's an understatement. God doesn't typically enter into history the way he did at the time of the Exodus. We have long periods of time where God seems to be silent. If we look just at the biblical record, God seemed to have been silent from the time that the patriarchs went into Egypt to the time that they left Egypt. That's a period of almost 400 years in which God was relatively silent. He wasn't entering into the affairs of human history in an obvious way. At least there's no record of it. That reminded me of a verse in 1 Samuel. I think I've read this before, but it starts out in the time of Eli, and Samuel was born under unusual circumstances, and his mother dedicated him to service in the temple. And he went to serve in the temple, and God came to speak to Samuel, and Samuel didn't know what it was. He didn't know who was calling him. And that event is talked about in chapter 3 of 1 Samuel. I won't read it. I just want to read verse 1, the preface to that event. And it says, "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent." So there are times when word of the Lord is rare, and there are times when it's not so rare. There are times when visions are rare, there are times when visions are not so rare. So there are different faces to God. There are times when God seems to be almost right in the midst of things, right in the midst of events. And there are other times when it seems like He's far, far away. And just letting things go along like the deist God, letting the clock tick along. And I was thinking about this with respect to our day. And it's a little hard to assess what God is doing right now. Is He silent or is He distant? But there is one thing happening today that makes me think that He is actually beginning to reach down and work in human affairs. And I think that is the example of the establishment of the State of Israel. Let me just recount some of the events that have led up to the establishment of the State of Israel. And it really seems to me, in just recently going through a survey of Western civilization in Gutenberg, kind of running through these events, it struck me how remarkable it is the way the recreation of Israel was set up, and then how God, at least in my view, made that happen. God had promised long ago that Israel would be the basis for a new kingdom. And He promised that that this would be a nation established that would never disappear. In the times of the Greeks and the Romans, the Jews were essentially kicked out of Israel. First, they were kicked out of Jerusalem, and it was made a totally pagan city. And then they were... that was an official act, and then they were less officially kicked out of Palestine as a whole. And having been kicked out, that's called the diaspora, or the diaspora, whichever you prefer, where the Greeks were, or the Jews were spread out to among all the nations. And one of the areas to which a large number of Jews migrated was Central and Eastern Europe. There was a very significant population that settled in the Eastern European countries, and particularly Poland. Part of the reason for that was they weren't allowed into Russia, and the Russians kept pushing them west into Poland. They lived also in Western Europe, but largely as outcasts, and were not integrated into society, were not accepted. And a spirit of hatred towards the Jews is a long-standing tradition in Europe. It's particularly severe in Russian history. Russians wouldn't allow Jews to live in Russia, except in the very western part of Russia. And even in those areas, in the Ukraine and western Russia, there were frequent pogroms in which the citizens of the area would rise up and either kill or torment the Jewish population. They were frequently scapegoats for problems in Russia. But anti-Semitism wasn't restricted to Russia. It was common in Central Europe as well, in the Balkan area, in Austria, very, very strong. But there was a certain amount of anti-Semitism throughout all of Europe. So in 1897, a Zionist movement developed. Jews began to think, we ought to have a state of our own. And we ought to have that state located geographically in our ancestral homeland, that is Palestine. So people began to lobby for that very thing. And then in 1917, the Prime Minister of England issued a declaration saying that there should be a Palestinian state established, an Israelite state established in Palestine, during a time when the strongest power in the area were the British. So for the British Prime Minister to make such a statement was significant. So slowly, Jews began to migrate towards Palestine over a long period of time, and at first it was very slow. But then World War II happened. And at the close of World War II, a war which clearly demonstrated to the horror of all of Europe the inhumanity that mankind, as evolved as he had become, was still capable of. And the greatest horror was the discovery of the death camps and some of the most numerous casualties of those death camps were the Jews. So there was quite a bit of sympathy that developed as a result of World War II and the death of all those Jews for some kind of state in Israel for them to go to. And it was motivated by two very different motivations. One was sincere sympathy for the Jews and thinking that they really do deserve a state of their own. And the other main motivation was a desire to get them out of Europe, to find a place for them to go and get rid of them. So a Jewish state was established finally in 1948 under a UN resolution. But there wasn't really any provision for it to be protected. And this state was being established in an area that was already occupied and was the homeland for another people, the Palestinians. And as a result, as seems probably quite natural, there was conflict between the two peoples. And there was a period of about 2 years in which there was warfare between the Jews and the Palestinians. But in the end, the Jewish state was indeed established, and an uneasy peace was established. Then, in 1967, some of the surrounding Arabic countries who had refused to recognize the existence of a Jewish state joined forces and were planning to attack Israel and to try to wipe it out. They formed an alliance. It was Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. They formed an alliance and were committing provocative acts laying the groundwork for a war. But the Israelis attacked first in 67, and in 6 days, the Israelis not only defeated this coalition, but they extended the boundaries of the Jewish state so that now it included the West and Jerusalem, areas that had been excluded from their territory previously, and areas that were key, as far as the Jews were concerned, to reestablishing their control over their ancestral land. The next big event was in the late 70s and early 80s. And that was Jews who were a large minority in the Soviet Union and had long been systematically persecuted for their ethnic origins, for being Jewish. And in fact, in Russia, everyone's passport, you had to have a passport even for internal use, whenever, like a driver's license. We carry a driver's license around for identification. In the Soviet Union, citizens had to carry an internal passport. And in that passport, there is a place where you have to indicate your nationality. Well, we think of nationality as the government under which we were born. But in Russian thinking, your nationality is your ethnic association. So Jews had to have stamped in their passport that they were Jewish. That meant any time they wanted to apply to a school, then they had to present their passport, and it was known then that they were Jewish. Any time that they wanted to get a job, they had to present their passport, etc. So discriminating against them was very easy and was rather systematic. I was teaching English to Soviet emigres, Russian Jews who were leaving, and the first place they had to go was to Rome, where they received a visa then to go to the United States or Canada or Australia or New Zealand. And one time they were asking me about affirmative action. I want to know what that was, and I was explaining it to them. And I said that it's a kind of quota system where a business has to have a certain percentage of all these groups. And they asked a very important question. They said, can they hire more than the quota of that particular group? And I said, as far as I know, yes, they can. And they said, that's great. Because in Russia, they have quotas too, but it's the maximum number of Jews that can be in a college, or the maximum number of Jews that can work in a certain place. And it's a very low number, so they liked our quotas. But there's an interesting combination of things here. One is, they were discriminated against over a long period of time. And secondly, there opened a window of opportunity for them to leave Russia. So they were very motivated to leave, and they left in huge numbers and are continuing to leave from Russia because of the unrest in Russia and to move to Israel. And an increasing proportion of those are coming not to the United States but going directly to Israel. As a result, the Russian Jewish population in Israel is the largest ethnic category of all the Jews in Israel. I couldn't find statistics on it, but I think that it's about 40 or 50% now of the population of Israel is Russian or Soviet Jews. So now that land has been heavily populated with Jews in a way that it never had been before they were released from the Soviet Union. And there is something else that is happening right now that I think is significant. I don't know how significant. Time will tell. I was talking to a Jewish fellow who lives here in town, and he had just returned this last summer from a convention in Colorado Springs, and he called it the Jewish Reform Movement, or the Tikkun Movement. And it was representatives of all different Jewish sects who had come together, and from all over the world. There were even Jews from Japan. I didn't know there were Jews in Japan. But there were Jews from all over the world that went to Colorado Springs, and the topic was, what does it mean to be Jewish? They were trying to sort out what is a Jew. And he said, for the most part, the thing that they agreed on was that their whole Jewishness comes from the Torah. So what's key then is a re-understanding of what the Torah says Jewishness is. And I thought that was phenomenal. That God would bring about a movement in which Jews would return to the Bible in order to determine what their ethnic identity is. Is God at work then in what is happening in Israel? It seems to me that He is. I remember the Six-Day War. Going into it, well, first of all, my brother and his wife went camping and missed it. They came back from their camping trip and the war had come and gone. But I remember at the very beginning of the war, the thinking was, Israel's no match. Is no match for the other countries. The other countries had been heavily armed by the Soviets. And it was three nations against one. And the one nation was a fledgling nation that didn't have much going for it. And yet, afterwards, everybody was kind of going, wow. And there were all kinds of jokes about what's the first thing to burn out on an Egyptian tank? It's the reverse lights and that sort of thing. But it really was a phenomenal event. It really changed people's opinion of what Israel is. And I think now we look at Israel and see it as a fairly significant state. It may not be one of the world powers, but it has significant military might. And when you think about the fact that it didn't exist 40 years ago, there was no Israel until 1948. And yet now it's a significant nation. So it seems to me that God is working. God is kind of reaching down into human history and doing some significant things to bring about the fulfillment of His promises. But as I'm going about my day-to-day activities, I'm focused on what's on my calendar for today. Is God working in human events? Do I see it? Not particularly. These things that seem to me fairly significant in the reestablishment of Israel, they take place in increments of once every 10 years something happens. That's not enough for my time scale. My time scale is from 2 hours before now and maybe a few minutes, 5 minutes into the future. But it's a very narrow little time span. It's difficult to pan back and look at things in perspective and see things in a way where God's activity becomes more apparent. I think of if I were to go out and sit in the garden and watch the flowers, I might see a bee come in, land on the flower and fly away. But I will see no growth in the flower. If I watch a Walt Disney time-lapse photography of that, I will see the growth, but I won't see the bee. And there are things that, in our little perspective of just day-to-day dealing with things, there are things that we focus on to an extreme. We see the bees, but we don't see the growth. It's only when you pull back and get a little perspective that you can see the growth and the bees fade to insignificance. So I think it's important to keep this in mind when we look at the Jews and their reaction to what God is doing, because they too have this really narrow perspective on what amount of time is significant. It's just this little period of time that's significant, and for the most part, it's now, right now. How do I feel right now? Is there any pain? And that's pretty much the way we go through life. I think I will stop there and give you time for comments or questions. Margaret?
How to think about Israel becoming a nation when they and their allies exercise behavior that in anybody else would call imperialistic. I don't know how to, whether to say yay or nay on their behavior. If God actually came down and said, Israel, thou shalt, you know, wage this war and take more land than you originally had and displace Palestinians, there wouldn't be any question in my mind that, sure, go for it. But when the Palestinians are being hurt, I'd like a little bit more. I know God does not approve of that in general, and so I'd like a little bit more evidence from Him that this is really what He'd like me to do. So at this point, just because they're Jews, I can't necessarily say that I endorse their behavior, because I really don't know what God thinks about it. I mean, certainly He has prospered the Jewish nation, and that's, but He may also slap their fingers for what they did. So I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I think that's right. We need to make a distinction between their moral acts and God working through them. That God can work through them even in the midst of them choosing immoral acts.
So you would call what they did an immoral act?
It seems to me that they have done things that, yes, are wrong. But one of the nice things about the drama that the Bible presents is that God is the master of taking sin and doing something redemptive with it. Essentially, that's our hope. And there are lots of instances where that's the case. I know I mentioned the story of David and Bathsheba. One of the things that puzzling and intriguing about that story is that David commits an evil act of adultery and then murder and then covers it up. But even though he does that, God chooses Bathsheba to produce Solomon, who ends up being inheriting. David is punished, it seems to me. The rest of the story of 2 Samuel is the punishment of David. So he's punished for the act, and yet God chooses to use that particular line to bring about the heir. The heir that ends in the line of even Jesus. So there are a lot of stories in the Bible as a whole of people doing evil things that God then uses for His purposes to bring about good.
Isn't that the point of Jocko Willis' book, The Meaning of the City? How many times God takes what is essentially a rebellious act and gives us what we really wanted and needed. It doesn't throw our choices out, but redeem them.
Anything else, Larry?
You were kind of giving us the history of the Jewish nation. I was trying to remember what the event was right before World War II.
The Balfour Declaration in 1917 was the one I mentioned before that. That was the first time that any government had made a declaration in favor of the establishment of an Israelite state. And it was made by Great Britain, which at that time was the dominant European power in that area.
Do you think there's a relationship between that and the death camps?
You mean that there was public sentiment in favor of such a thing, of the establishment of an Israelite nation? That Hitler was reacting against that? I don't know for sure. I am currently reading a biography of Hitler, and it would appear that anti-Semitism had become very, very strong, first in the Balkans, and then in the Austro-Hungarian Empire when it began to incorporate the Balkans into its empire. And the center of that was Vienna, where Hitler spent several years as a young man. Just an interesting sidelight. At the same time, there was a rebirth of Teutonic paganism. There were people who were studying Teutonic paganism and trying to resurrect it as a religion. It's not clear whether Hitler was directly influenced by that, but people associated with Hitler were directly associated with that. Yes? Teutonic paganism is the paganism practiced by the ancient Germans, the Germanic peoples. The swastika, by the way, was one of the pagan symbols that the Nazis, they chose that as indicating their roots back into the Teutonic period. It was a Teutonic religious symbol.
Have you read Alice Miller's
book? No. What is that?
It's a book about, basically, a biography of Hitler, psychological bias.
Well, actually, a whole Jewish, using Hitler as a specific.
I see.
A whole Jewish community. But the moment in that community that might be such a
decline. That would be interesting. That would be interesting. Just another comment. There was, while we're throwing books out, Hannah Arendt wrote a book about Eichmann and the role that he played in the Holocaust. And his job essentially was, how do you get all these people to the death camps in an efficient way and work out all the logistics of that? He was a high-ranking Nazi official who had a Jewish mistress. And it explains, how could one do that? How could one live like that? And he was able to do it because he didn't think of them as people. He thought of it as a logistical challenge. How do you pull this off? Pretty interesting.
What do you think of that recent assassination of Israel? Do you have any kind of far-reaching perspective to how that maybe played out?
I don't really know. I don't know.
Maybe because he was about to hand over or hand back.
Yeah. My sneaking suspicion is that land will not be given back as a result of that. And my sneaking suspicion is that the control of the Israelite state of Israel will extend into some of those areas that otherwise, and I suspect more and more Palestinians might be driven out, I don't know, of Israel. But I don't know. Yes? Well, the Torah. Technically, the Torah is the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. But sometimes the Torah, the term is used more broadly, it just means the Old Testament.
And the Jews,
they recognized it as I guess they would have recognized it as inspired. That it was a holy book, the whole thing was the holy book for them. Yes. Mm-hmm. Roger.
These Jews that were meeting in Colorado, were they going to use the Talmud?
I don't know. He didn't go into great detail. He was just saying that they were having these talks. And we've got Hasidic Jews, Orthodox, Reformed, even atheistic Jews, all coming together trying to figure out what does it mean to be Jewish. And he was saying the thing that there seemed to be consensus about was that their Jewishness is to be rediscovered here. Okay.
One thing that makes me, I mean, that's nice that they're doing that, but and short of a miracle, some of the stuff that's really kind of grossed me out lately is running into Jews who are just, it's a purely cultural thing. Combination of a cultural thing, a genetic thing, and a let's be nice to everybody else because we know what it's like. People aren't nice to us. There's a lady who writes a column in the Register Guard, alternates with Don Bishop's column. I forget her name. You know, Karen McGowan. She wrote a column last week, I guess, or the week before about brothers. Sister, there's a baby who's just a lovely little child, less than a year old, has been diagnosed with something that's going to kill her before she's a year old. And about how the point of the article was that how important family is in these situations. Everybody gathers together and supports each other. Kind of thing. But the last paragraph was sort of an example of one of these things that just makes me want to tear my hair out of the screen, where she says that they had people supporting them from all faiths, Buddhists, Christians, whatever, and that she said the thing that was most satisfying to her was an explanation provided by a Buddhist friend, which said she must have been born a soul already very close to perfection. And I've been wrestling with writing her a letter saying, are you interested in what's really true, or are you only interested in feeling good? Because she mentioned that she's Jewish, they're Jewish, her family's Jewish. Do you understand the worldview this Buddhist is coming from that makes her say this? And that it's completely 180 degrees from the worldview that you theoretically believe in as a Jew? You can't both be right. I appreciate this is a difficult situation for you, but are you interested in knowing where this child is going or why this child has died, or are you merely interested in feeling good about it? Because feeling good about it lacks integrity to a great degree, if that's your criteria. She makes this big deal about this is, you know, they're Jewish. And then she goes and endorses something this Buddhist person says because it's just sweet. It makes us feel good. And it just turns my stomach. It really does. Because what's the point of their Judaism? I'm not sure I'm sure that she's a very nice lady, but if you were to... And in theory, she would be one of these people, I'm sure, that would agree, yeah, let's look at the Torah. Very Jewish thing. Let's look at the Torah. But if what the amount of the Torah required her to tell her Buddhist friend, you know, I don't think that's a good explanation for what's happening to my niece. I think she'd say, hell with the Torah. And it wouldn't surprise me if a good chunk of the Jews would do that too.
Yeah. Time will tell whether... whether God is acting in the hearts of Jews right now to bring a significant number to faith, I don't know. Time will tell. Okay, thanks.